Hey everybody, welcome back to this week's episode of the show. Before I begin, I just want to thank everybody who did listen to us last week and gave some great feedback and well-received support. I'm glad to see that people are enjoying the podcast and the content that I'm putting out there. On this week's episode, we're going to talk about the global coffee trade and what changes in that market are going to mean for some stocks that you might be watching or even holding in your portfolios. Kenya, Uganda, Ethiopia, and Somalia aren't countries we think of very often, but they all have one thing in common, and it's not just their shared borders. Those four countries represent about one-third of the world's coffee production. Their coffee has been favored for the last 5 years, since by comparison, political instability in South America has trumped that of East Africa. The Horn of Africa, one of the world's most impoverished regions, is in the midst of a locust superswarm of 200 billion insects, which crossed the Gulf of Aden and arrived in Somalia and Ethiopia in January of this year. They were spotted in Kenya about 2 months ago in what's become the worst infestation there in 70 years. This came after a series of large cyclones passed over the Rub al Khali Desert in Saudi Arabia. After the cyclones, lakes formed between all the sand dunes. The desert was filled with water for the first time in 20 years. They caused catastrophic flooding in normally dry areas across the region. Today, the floodwaters have receded, but they left behind the perfect conditions for a locust infestation. If a normally dry area becomes unusually lush with vegetation, as it would after heavy rains, the insects will start to congregate. The sudden crowding triggers a hormone, and the locusts change, both physically and mentally. Its body shrinks and its endurance increases, which optimizes it for flight. The brain grows and so does the appetite. This is called the gregarious phase. They eat and breed, leaving their eggs in the damp soil. When they hatch, they form what are called hopper bands, swarms of thousands of non-flying but voracious insects that move together as a unit. Eventually, they develop wings and they take flight. It's almost impossible to stop them. Locusts ride the wind, which allows them to travel up to 100 miles each day. A single swarm can contain up to 150 million insects per square kilometer. Each one consumes its body weight in vegetation every day. In 24 hours, a swarm of that size can eat more food than 35,000 people. The UN Food and Agriculture Organization, the FAO, estimates that one locust invasion in Kenya covered around 2,400 square kilometers and contained up to 200 billion locusts. That's a swarm of insects over three times the size of New York City, which could eat the equivalent biomass of tens of millions of people. In February, Pakistan also declared a state of emergency. By late May, another swarm had reached parts of northern India for the first time since 1962, and the biggest factor in all of this is the weather. Locusts reproduce exponentially when the weather's in their favor, and with every new generation, the population increases 20-fold. So if a normally dry area stays wet for a long time, the population explodes. This is exactly what happened in Saudi Arabia, Brazil, which we'll get to in a moment, and India, where historic levels of rain fell in extremely short periods of time. The unusual amount of rain led to an unusual amount of vegetation, which led to an unusual number of new locusts. A single perfect storm isn't enough to bring in swarms of locusts of this size. It takes a series of them, something that used to be really rare in these vulnerable areas. Unfortunately, extreme weather that used to be rare suddenly becoming more common is one of the hallmarks of extreme climate change. That could mean a future with more cyclones in the desert, more greenery where there once was sand, and more breeding grounds for locusts. Brazil's story adds to the coffee confusion. In March, too much rain fueled the biggest coffee rally in years, just as other markets crumbled under the weight of COVID. While rain is usually welcome at this time of year, when crops are developing, soggier than normal conditions affect roots, causing leaves and fruit to drop and fungal diseases to spread, and providing another perfect breeding ground for locusts. Futures of Arabica and Robusta coffee beans, the former being the mild-tasting variety preferred by Starbucks, gained 13% in March while equities tumbled. That month, coffee capped its steepest three-day jump since mid-2016. A reduction in global inventories added to bullish sentiment. Coffee stockpiles, held in port warehouses monitored by the ICE Futures Exchange, fell by 2,260 kilogram bags on March 2nd. Inventories held by Brazilian farmers are already low, while producers in Colombia and Honduras remain in good inventory so far, albeit with no more harvests until next spring. Still, it's not one-way traffic in terms of fundamentals, and price swings have surged. The 60-day volatility reading for coffee futures is the highest since April 2015. The bearish scenario appeared obvious when prices were falling 21% a few months prior in January, before that historic rally. Brazil's output appeared poised to approach the record high for the on-year of a biennial cycle, and the slump in the real price boosted the appeal of exports priced in the dollar. Even with rains damping prospects, Brazil was set to deliver a huge harvest. On the demand side, the spread of the coronavirus to several countries threatened consumption levels at restaurants and cafes. The market found some support from a recent surge in Amazon's online coffee sales, and news that Brazil had already sold 60% of its 2020 crop. This was only possible because Brazil harvests coffee from April to October, saving this year's crop from most of the flooding and pretty much all of the locusts. Every other coffee-producing nation would be harvesting right now from January through April, meaning all their harvestable coffee was probably eaten by locust swarms. Inventories tend to be a lagging indicator, though. What they usually demonstrate is that interest is continuing. If futures and spot prices stay similar, everything is good. But the disconnect now is pretty huge. Current global warehouse inventories have fallen at a fairly normal rate. March to June showed a decrease from about 2 to 1.6 million 60-kilogram bags. For context, inventories usually hover around 2 million from December to April. The futures market is where it gets a little bit confusing. Robusta coffee futures, for example, for September 2020 are down when inventories are down, an inverse correlation. Even more concerning is that September 21 futures are settling 10% higher when inventories are still projected to be higher. The divergence in spot and futures prices that we're experiencing now is called contango. It's not a crazy revelation. Contango happens often and is part of the normal ebb and flow of the commodities market. The problem with coffee in particular is that futures prices are fluctuating with even more volatility than in years past and are still inversely correlated with inventory. Since 2012, settlement prices year to year have fallen by 40%. This makes sense as global coffee inventories have been increasing since then. But contextually, for the first time in almost a decade, 12-month futures prices are higher with less demand and historically high harvests affecting current inventories, which really won't be normalized for another 2 years, until after another rotation of planting and harvesting, post-locusts and post-COVID. The markets are really only starting to price in the effects of this disaster, and the shockwaves won't come until we can look at the crop destruction data from Africa, East Asia, and South America. The three continents make up 86% of global coffee production. If all three lose even half of their crop, coffee prices could at least double. Globally, earnings from coffee exports represent a significant share of the revenues of many East African countries. Although the importance of coffee in their economies has diminished with greater development, the average share of coffee in total merchandise exports exceeds 20% for countries like Burundi and Ethiopia. To this effect, since 2010, the number of people employed by the coffee industry in Burundi and Ethiopia, both extremely underdeveloped agro-economies, has grown pretty significantly. In Burundi, the coffee industry employs a quarter of the exploding population, which is now unemployed with virtually no safety net during what would have been the busiest time of the year. Chinese infrastructure investment might provide some respite during the crisis and some other temporary jobs, but instability in the markets and concerns over global China trade deals could mess with price stability and, more concerningly, GDP in already struggling underdeveloped nations. The evolution of coffee markets in East Africa has really taken place in the context of increased international regulation. State intervention in commodity markets was based on a double justification. First, a stabilization policy in agricultural markets was meant to guarantee parity between the industrial sector and agriculture. Second, a policy supporting farm incomes was meant to stabilize the whole economy of an agro nation, since agriculture was not thought to follow the business cycle. In this perspective, governments sought to counteract the business cycle by taking advantage of the inelasticity of agricultural supply. This was based on the idea that price decreases and commodity markets were a problem not only for farmers, but also for society as a whole. In a Keynesian perspective, farmer income support was part of an overall macroeconomic stabilization framework. In the framework of these Keynesian policies adopted after the Second World War through the 1980s, foreign trade was subordinated to the domestic goals of price stability and full use of national resources, especially full employment. Exports, like public expenditure, participated in the relaunching of the economy by increasing the outlets for a nation's companies. In agriculture, the search for stability implied a strict partitioning between domestic and international markets. Stabilization policies elaborated in the second half of the 20th century included instruments that ensured the disconnection between domestic prices and international prices, like import quotas, variable levies, and export subsidies. World markets, as such, were fragmented into a sum of disconnected and national markets. In a sense, international markets operated like locks between national markets, handling the transfer of products without calling into question the level or stability of prices at the national level. Countries trade only surpluses and deficits in international markets in quantities required to ensure equilibrium and hence the stability of the domestic market. Keynesian Western economists view this as the, quote, adoption of the European model across the formerly colonial world. International regulation and domestic deregulation create a parity between markets, which in times of great distress often results in high levels of structural contango that we're seeing across multiple commodities markets, although in a perfect world they do more or less ensure stable backwardation. Now let's talk about the market impact of this. Starbucks, the world's biggest coffee chain, uses 88 million pounds of coffee a year with margins per cup of about 1 to 6. For reference, a small cappuccino costs Starbucks around 30 cents in coffee, 30 cents for the cup and lid, $2.50 in overhead and payroll, and another 20 cents in milk and additives. For a price of $4, a small cappuccino makes about 60 cents. A Starbucks location makes about $100,000 a year in gross profit, and beverages generate 74% of that revenue. If coffee prices double in the next year, Starbucks' margin goes from 60 to 30 cents a cup, not adjusting for more complicated accommodations stores are forced to make for COVID restrictions. Compound this with relatively small growth in 2019 compared to its competitors, which we'll get to in a moment, widespread store closures, and the COVID pandemic eating into demand, Starbucks is about to have a few pretty bad years. They're the best case scenario, though. Smaller companies and independent coffee shops have even tighter margins, especially in large cities where rent is expensive and customers fluctuate greatly. They also pay more for their coffee. Starbucks has contracts with its own growers and roasts the coffee beans themselves. By contrast, a small operation like a local coffee shop might purchase from a middleman at a greater price to accommodate another profit margin. The bearish outlook sees Starbucks barely breaking even without increasing prices or higher sales of food, which account for about 20% of its sales. To the chagrin of its customers, Starbucks already increased its prices 2 years ago after coffee prices in 2017 ate into their profit margins. For context, a kilogram of roasted coffee traded for $2.40 in 2017, but only $1.42 today. The next largest competitors by market share are Dunkin' Donuts and Tim Hortons. Dunkin' Donuts operates 22,000 locations globally, and although we associate them with coffee, donut sales and bolstered demand for Baskin-Robbins should put Dunkin' Donuts in a better position with increased coffee prices than Starbucks. Tim Hortons is the third largest. Where Dunkin' Donuts and Starbucks have around 28,000 stores, Tim Hortons has about 8. They do have a unique advantage, though. Over half of their locations are self-serve kiosks where no employees are necessary except for maintenance. Profit margins in this case tend to be significantly higher. As long as contango continues and coffee futures price in the devastating impact from recent months later this year, Tim Hortons and Dunkin' Donuts should outpace Starbucks, at least in their profits. The economics of coffee get more complicated from there. Coffee fields destroyed by flooding have decreased yield, and higher coffee prices won't make up for much. Based on the example I laid out, a customer might be paying 30 cents for the coffee in the cappuccino, but after all the middlemen are paid, a coffee farmer in Africa earns about 8 cents for a kilogram of raw green coffee beans. South American farmers earn even less, while their same coffee trades for 70 cents a pound on the open market. Middlemen run away with the bulk of the profit, taking the difference between what the grower makes and what the coffee company buys it for, less transportation and storage fees. Finally, packaged, roasted coffee is resold to customers for between $9 and $20 a pound, depending on the brand. Other companies somewhere around the middle of that supply chain, like Maxwell House, Nestle, and Folgers, could get hurt too. The economics of coffee hit hard. The total impact of the coffee industry in the U.S. alone in 2015 was $225 billion, while coffee-related economic activity comprised 1.6% of total U.S. GDP. In 2020, that may have been closer to 2%. Consumers spent $74 billion on coffee 5 years ago, fueling the almost 2 million jobs tied to the industry and the $30 billion in taxes it generates. The bigger impact of this crisis doesn't just stop at coffee, although that's where our focus will end for now. The last large locust outbreak, which started in 2003 and lasted until 2005 in the Middle East and West Asia, resulted in an estimated $2.5 billion in crop damage alone. Crop damage also means no feed for animals and no grazing grounds for cattle, which make up a huge portion of food consumption in Africa. Toxic, unregulated pesticides used to control the locust plague delay further damage to more natural grasslands. The potential hunger threat is tremendous in a region where 42 million people were already slated to face acute food insecurity. In so many words, the situation as it presents itself now isn't great. It's very likely that an agricultural crisis like this one will send shocks through global markets for the next few years and force either a mass global reimagination of agricultural and trade policy or a deep intervention into underdeveloped nations. On an even larger scale, increased frequency of strange climate events will only propel us into further disarray. But in the meantime, at least now you know not to be surprised when your $8 coffee becomes $12. Thank you all for tuning into this week's episode. I hope you enjoyed my little lecture on the coffee trade. Next week, we're going to be talking about bonds and the Federal Reserve's recent buyback of tons of investment grade and non-investment grade corporate bonds and what that means for the banking system and the bond market worldwide. If you enjoyed the show, please feel free to share this among your friends and continue to give us any feedback you might have. It's greatly appreciated. Thanks again, and I'll see you all next week.